deceptively dense few paragraphs, but I also must admit it is the 4th of July. I have to get out of town before parade traffic prevents me from getting to Marquette, and most of you have visions of bratwurst dancing in your heads anyway, so just know that for everything I say, there are about 1,000 things I could say and want to say. But because I love you, I will be concise. But you know, if you ever want to chat me up about it later, you know how to reach me. Anyway, this story picks up right on the heels of last week's story, or I should say right on the bloody next dump of last week's story, literally, because David is still holding Goliath's head in his hands when this passage begins. Like, put that down. That's disgusting. We get it. You won. Now go wash your hands. Anyway, Saul is impressed, as can be, with David. Which, of course, he is. He just killed a giant with a tiny little rock, prompting Saul to ask perhaps the most small-town question I can think of. Son, who's your daddy? That's what the ancient world and small towns have in common. They're obsessed with who's related to who. David answered him, Jesse, from Bethlehem. To which Saul says, cool, go say your goodbyes to your dad because you're never going back. You live with me now. And I guess when the king tells you to leave home because he has a spot for you in his castle, you go. You go. It's at this point where David meets Jonathan. There's so much to say about this. Okay, I'll say a little bit about it. First off, let's acknowledge the elephant in the room. I, at least as a 28-year-old in the year 2021, I read this description of their relationship and I think, yeah, that sounds pretty gay. Good for them, whatever. I also know that a lot of people read this passage and think they must be best friends, largely because there's this weird belief that being gay is new and not a thing that's been happening from the dawn of time, coupled with the belief that anybody as important as David couldn't possibly ever have been attracted to a dude. I read commentaries that are adamant David and Jonathan were a couple. And they have compelling evidence, things that David and Jonathan did together, ways their relationship was described, that were usually reserved for describing husbands and wives. I've also read commentaries that were adamant David and Jonathan, absolutely not a couple. And all of the kind of awkwardness in the way their relationship is described disappears when you look at it through the lens of what was normal at the time. For example, later on, David describes Jonathan's love as surpassing that of women, which sounds pretty on the nose. Until you remember that many ancient societies believed that true love could only exist between men because women weren't capable of it. Sorry, Luke, I'm doing my best. Here's where I come down on this, and this is true. Nobody knows. I don't know. Those commentary writers, they don't actually know. Only David and Jonathan and God know, and they're not talking. So what I do know doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Let's say they are gay, for argument's sake. Doesn't negatively impact their role in God's unfolding story. They're no less chosen, they're no less loved, they're no less important. And let's say they aren't gay, for argument's sake. No way means that being gay isn't a valid thing to be. It doesn't mean anything. No, their relationship is important, though. It's not important because they may or may not have been in love. It's important because it demonstrates how Jonathan is way more allied with David than with Saul, his own dad. Jonathan's allegiance lies with David. Saul's own child was more invested in the success of a potential rival of Saul than in Saul himself. And that is a shocking lack of loyalty for a time when family was everything. Yet there we have it. He gives him his royal robe, his princely robe, his weaponry, as a symbolic sign that David is the rightful next in line, not Jonathan. That's what we're supposed to get out of that above everything else. It seems everybody is against Saul, even his own son, even God. God at least is against To be clear, I've never been king before, but I do have some experience with rapidly dwindling popularity. The stress seems to be getting to Saul, and Saul, he is not quite himself. Stress is hard to deal with. I've been short with people that didn't deserve it when I'm stressed. I've picked fights that shouldn't have been picked when I'm stressed. I've made mistakes in my work when I'm stressed. Stress is tough. I've never tried to murder anybody with a spear because of stress, though. It becomes apparent here that Saul has some issues. Whether you believe Saul was literally possessed, or you believe possession was the ancient world's way of talking about mental illness, or if you believe something in between, the common thing we can agree on is Saul is not okay. All around good guy David did his best to help Saul. He would sing to him, he would play music on his lyre for him, and that worked to a point. I believe wholeheartedly in the healing power of music, but it isn't quite a cure. Saul comes and David tries to pin him to the wall with his spear, not once, but twice, and both times David's like, you know, everybody deserves another chance. So he sticks around, which is crazy. He stays with Saul. It isn't David who tries to get as far away from possible from Saul. It's not David who runs away. It's Saul who sends David away. The passage literally says Saul was afraid of David. The guy with the spear is afraid of the kid with the guitar. That's the kind of thing that much power can do to a person. The thought of losing power becomes, in their minds, literally a fate worse than death. Out of jealousy, Saul sends David away, sends him to lead the military. And you know, I can't help but wonder if his hope was that David would die in battle. I can't help but wonder if this is where David learned that trick he pulled with Bathsheba's husband down the road, which we'll get to on another Sunday. Because David hadn't played against him first, except David was too good. David didn't die, quite the opposite. He became a superstar. All of Israel knew him as the guy who was leading Israel on to bigger and bigger military victories. There's this saying that became popular in Israel at this time: Saul has killed 1,000, but David has killed 10,000. Saul became out of sight, out of mind for the people of Israel, while David became the man everybody saw, the man who was leading the people, the one they saw risking his neck alongside their husbands and their brothers and their sons. Saul's plan to send David away, to get him out of sight, to make this problem go away, backfires in the most spectacular way possible. And it becomes just one more step up David's ladder to being the quintessential king of Israel. Pay attention, friends, to the things that make David such a good king: loyalty, self-sacrifice, grace and forgiveness, intelligence, faith. Sounds like qualities you want in any leader, right? It's much more important than ruthlessness or physical strength or smooth talking. Unfortunately, falling prey to giving in to those qualities may just be part and parcel of the whole royal gig. That, however, is a conversation for another day and another step along David's journey. Today, though, we can know that the seeds we plant out of jealousy or greed or a hunger for power do not ultimately produce a fruit that's worth eating. The ones planted in good faith and love, though, those are the ones that yield more than we could imagine. I want you to join me in singing our hymn of response. It's found in your little letter.